Pastor.
Good morning, good morning. My name is not Carol. My name is Ginny Corsi. I am a pinch hitter today. Carol was taken ill and could not make it, and I'm thrilled and delighted to be here. Now, let me tell you, for the tape, this is April 11th, session number 3102, entitled U.S. Aristocracy. Pass the privilege, please. That's an interesting title, as are many in this conference, aren't they? You know the drill, probably. We're here for an hour. I'd like 50 minutes, maybe 45 minutes, simply to be our wonderful speakers here today with us. The last 15 would be questions from you. And I'm urging you, as you listen, if you have a question come up, don't wait to try to remember what that question was. Write it down. And we have cards here, as well as the app. Cards, white cards, just put your hand up, they'll come. You'll save those questions or you'll send them right up here. I'll be reading and giving them to the speakers. Students get privilege here, you know. And on behalf of the CWA, I want to welcome Summit Middle School. Raise your hand, Summit. A large crowd. And they apparently get a day off from school, and I guess you're pretty happy about that. Welcome here, and please don't be afraid or hesitate to write your questions down, and let's make the most of your curiosity here at CWA. This topic of privilege is an interesting one. Interesting, I've been thinking about it in the morning hours as I realized I was pinch hitting. I'm Ginny Corsi. I'm a business consultant and a moderator here for a number of years now. Many of you are privileged, but we don't recognize it. We're privileged in our education. We're privileged in where we live. We're privileged in many other ways, too. The word privilege seems to become a household word in America these days. It's fostered sometimes by women toward men now, by persons of color who feel disenfranchised, by privilege by tax policy, and what used to be assumed as socioeconomic divisions. We're faced with the challenge of coping with this word of privilege and the curbing the divisions in the future from this growing polarity. We have three unique people here today to talk about this. Pochi, did you say you wanted to go
last?
Last. But so did Nadia. And I think it's interesting. You know, I run a very informal meeting. I think Pochi, I want you to go first. Pochi, and that's the moderator rules. Pochi comes with 10 years of experience in entrepreneurship at the University of California at Berkeley and has been teaching also in Hong Kong and mainland China. He comes with a very interesting perspective on this word of privilege because it can also weave in immigration into this. I'm very eager to hear his perspective on it. We also are happy to have Michael Spencer here for the second year. Michael comes from the UK and is going to give you a more historic perspective on privilege in terms of classism in the United Kingdom. He grew up with it. He knows it well. Michael also happens to be a very highly regarded person in the art world as someone who is a leader in performance design. Lastly, Nadia Firozvi I want to say this because I think I'm very impressed with it, is a project manager for the Just and Inclusive Society Project at this bipartisan foundation called the Democracy Fund. And her background includes working in the Office of Civil Rights and Liberties in the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. I'm personally thrilled that we are to have you here. I'm going to ask you, Pochi, to begin with your interesting perspective on entrepreneurialism and our topic today of privilege.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for the kind introduction. I'm particularly pleased to see the school-aged children here, and I want to particularly call your attention to where your future is going to be, whether you come from a more privileged background or you are more modest, let's call it, background, and of course, immigrants. I think it's very important to remember that America really, truly is the land that has been built by immigrants, right, from the very, very beginning. And I do a lot of, prior to my teaching, I've been a venture capitalist for over 30 years and also working with early stage companies. The vast majority of them would not exist without the immigrants. Now, I'm talking about immigrants with all different kinds of skills and backgrounds and interests, from very highly trained scientists and engineers to people who run, you know, little coffee shops and services. These are all part of an entire ecosystem. We have to remember that our society is a very complex ecosystem, very much like a natural biological ecosystem. All the component parts are interdependent. We can't favor one too much over another. There has to be some kind of dynamic balance. It's not a static balance, it's dynamic. It continuously changes. And that's one of the key concepts of entrepreneurship. Now, when I talk about entrepreneurship, I'm not referring to this notion that, you know, you're going to be a startup founder, and you're going to create this company that's going to change the world, and you're going to make billions of dollars. Yes, there are people who can do that, and maybe one of you will be, but that's not the goal. The goal of being of the entrepreneurial journey is actually one of personal growth, personal transformation, to learn to have the courage to explore what you don't know, to learn how to work with other people with different talents. And it's very, very critical. Today, every business, every industry, every profession requires people with different, not just personalities, but different skills. Problems are much more complex. You can't solve them the way we used to think maybe 30, 40 years ago. So you need to learn how to work with people. Critical, critical thing. And, you know, part of that is learning to have tolerance and acceptance and understanding and empathy. Empathy turns out to be one of the most critical personal characteristics of entrepreneurs. Successful entrepreneurs are actually quite empathetic. They may not behave that way, right? They're all arrogant and full of bravado, and they're super salesmen and so on. You don't have to be like that, and that is not a necessary condition for your success. The other aspect of immigration is that this is how immigrants have an opportunity when they come to America or to any country, right? They typically come with very little resource, right? They come from hardship, they come from places that, for example, here now in America, right, we're so concerned about Latin Americans and Mexicans, and you know, many of them truly are fearing for their lives, and they come seeking some type of hope. So this is what entrepreneurship is really about. It's about hope. There has to be hope for the future. Once we lose that idea, right? Once we start to close things down and say, no, there's no hope. We need to be guided by fear. Then this whole problem of privilege goes away. Privilege is no longer privilege. It becomes walled gardens. People who have privilege think they need to build walls, literally, around themselves, around their property, in order to protect themselves. But guess what? They're actually putting themselves in a jail, right? That's what jails do. You think you're protecting everyone else from the the inmates, but actually you're protecting the inmates from everyone outside. Well, my time is almost up, so I'd like to have a more of an interactive conversation with all of you, as well as my fellow panelists. Thank you.
Thank you, Pochi. That was great. I had never thought of entrepreneurs' number one quality that's desired is empathy. And that's interesting. I want to pursue that more. Now I want to turn to Michael. Michael, you come from the UK? You, more than anyone here, understands what classes are like and what privilege is like. Talk to us about your perspective.
Okay, thank you.
And if that really works well, by the way.
No, it doesn't. I'm here because I'm privileged. It's important to say that, I think. I think privilege is relevant, is relative. To some extent, we're all privileged. And to some extent, we're all hypocrites because we deny it, I think. We all exhibit, perhaps, something called unconscious bias, bias that we don't even realize is there. And I'm a hypocrite as well, because, believe it or not, I've been presented to the Queen of England, Elizabeth II, at the at Buckingham Palace. But I've been presented to the Queen, okay, but I'm a Republican in European terms. I want to be a citizen, not a subject. I want to be a partner, not a servant. So, a little bit about myself. My father worked in the docks all his life. My mother worked in retail. I was the first to go into higher education. So, by definition, I class myself as lower middle class in the UK. The middle class is a huge wad of the UK, and I'm lower middle class. I work in the arts, so I'm surrounded by people who are privileged. I don't particularly fit in very well to that. I'm there because there was a political ideology for a brief moment in the UK history where people like me were encouraged to go into higher education, and we got free higher education. That no longer exists, so, you know. That might not be the case in future years. In the UK, class has always been the elephant in the room. And I would say the problem in the UK is that you can never escape your class, your roots. You cannot make enough money to buy that escape. Class is culture. You cannot understand enough about culture to escape your roots. I make performances, and I made a piece of work called Class a few years ago. In class, I was wearing running gear, and I stood in the middle of a studio next to a start line with a piece of wood that marked the start line. As the music started, I ran across the room, I touched the wall, I ran back, and I touched the other wall. I did this for 20 minutes till I was exhausted, but each time I passed the start line, I tripped on the piece of wood. Because you cannot escape in the UK where you were born and your class. Lindsay Hanley wrote a very good book in England called Respectable, Crossing the Class Divide, in which she kind of identifies the issue in the UK. She proposes that lower middle class people don't aspire to power, they don't feel comfortable with success, because their entire bringing has conditioned them to think it's not respectable to do so. I think that's true. In the US, the theory is that you can acquire privilege through hard work. Isn't that what the American dream is supposed to be about? If you work hard, you can buy class, you can buy privilege. And to some extent, that is the case, although I can see that, like in the UK, that new money is despised here. There is a kind of difference between people who are making money and people who have the money and always have it, just like in the UK. The American Dream. I was raised on the theatre of Arthur Miller, Tennessee Williams, the films of Peter Bogdanovich and Mike Newell, the literature of Steinbeck, Salinger, Casey and Sinclair, the poetry of Ginsberg. Of course, by the age of 19, I had no doubt that the American Dream was a tool used to control the American people, a dangled carrot made of fool's gold. And I still do. Conclusions. I can deal with people who are privileged. I can deal with it. They are an inevitability in a capitalist society. The US needs such people to justify the myth of the American dream, and in doing so maintain its own aristocracy, just as in the UK the class system maintains ours. So I can deal with people like the royal family, but what I can't deal with is people who are privileged but who don't think that they are or deny that they are. That for me is a problem. As I said, privilege, to finish, is all relative, and I'm a hypocrite because if I was 10 years younger or if I was 10 years older, I wouldn't be here now. If I'd have been born black or a woman or disabled, I would not be here now. I would not have had the opportunities that I had to get here. And, you know, it's a bit sad that we are a rather pale panel and it's a rather pale audience, but that's, you know, that's kind of, that tells us something, I think. For us humans now, I thought about it, it's not so much survival of the fittest, so much as survival sure is a hell of a lot easier the more privileged you are. That's all I want to say.
Thank you, James. James. I do have to ask that question right now, though. You say that you never escape privilege, you never can move classes, but you have.
No, I haven't.
The Queen. I think being in front of the Queen might say that you'd crossed over.
No, I haven't.
Oh, we're going to pursue that a little bit, too. Great. Nadia, let's turn to you and your experience with the issue of this interesting title of U.S. I'm going to say it again, U.S. aristocracy, pass the privilege, please. What do you think about U.S. aristocracy? What do you know? What are you working on today to change, if we need to change that?
Sure. Thank you for having me and for coming out on a snowy day. To Michael's sort of last point also about just this panel and the makeup, there was another individual, James Bell, who was unfortunately not able to be here. And I just would want to say that I think that this panel is incomplete without him. And so I think it's important to sort of recognize that,
sure.
That without
now, pull your microphone over.
Sure. Without the, I don't want to, your sign there, sorry. But without the sort of experiences of more communities of color, particularly the African American community, I think that this panel is incomplete. So, but to that end,
Wilson,
in terms of maybe defining privilege in some way, and then some of the work that I, working in philanthropy, or attempting to do to address some of what we see, I guess I would sort of maybe ask, what does success look like for some people, and what hasn't it looked like for other people? And that with privilege, I think that there is an inherent benefit that some people may get by belonging to a dominant group. And because now we also have people who have so many more, who have more than just one identity, then privilege sometimes depends on the sort of space and the situation that you find yourself in. And sometimes I think privilege gets conflated with lived experience. And that's where I think defensiveness can sort of come in, and where class sometimes can come in as well. So when it comes to the work that I'm doing, I work at an organization called Democracy Fund. We are a foundation, a bipartisan foundation, as Ginny has mentioned, and I work in a project called the Just and Inclusive Society Project. And as part of my work, I think it's important to recognize that there are communities in the United States and around the world, First Nation tribes, Black communities, immigrants, Latinx, Asian Americans, women, LGBTQ communities, and others that have been unfairly disadvantaged. I think it's important to sort of express it that way instead of always referring to this as undeserved privilege. I think it's important to recognize that there has been disadvantage and there has been sort of forceful disadvantagement of people. And so in terms of my grant making, I think, in terms of our grant making rather, we want to sort of recognize systems of white supremacy, of anti-Black racism, of Islamophobia, misogyny, of xenophobia, of homophobia, that have been created that you know contribute to narratives and policies and institutions that dehumanize and exclude harm and can also harm vulnerable communities. And so through our grant making, I think it's important to sort of recognize that that is sort of our starting point, and that the role that we need to have with our grant making is to try to remedy some of those ills and to address those systems through a values-based and kind of collaborative approach to our grant making. And so what I mean by that is, by virtue of having the purse strings, so to speak, I am absolutely in a position of privilege in terms of where the dollars will be going. Mm-hmm. But I think within philanthropy, we need to be creating a more participatory process, one where those communities who are applying for funds and more, where those communities who have been unfairly disadvantaged should be sort of a part of the decision-making process in terms of where the dollars go and in how these communities can grow and do better with the grant making. And so we're really interested in creating that kind of dynamic and creating those sorts of processes to address what I think are inherent privileges and to acknowledge that there are some communities that simply face more struggles than others. I'm often asked, for example, when people say, well, I don't necessarily have privilege. And one of the questions that I will ask of someone who might ask me that question, someone who is white who might ask me that question is, well, then do you speed when you drive? And if you do, and you are pulled over, are you someone that fears being shot? Because if you don't, then you are privileged, and you have an understanding of what that is. And that is not how a significantly large section of the community, that young black men who are 21 more times likely to sort of be incarcerated than any other community, this is something that we have to constantly be aware of and constantly be cognizant of our own privilege in the way in which we are making space for others. And I guess that's a great place to stop. Thanks.
Thank you, Nadia. You know, I'm getting these questions right now, and I'm thinking, if you don't mind, first of all, let me ask if any of you have questions for each other based on what you've just said.
I have a question for Nadia, and I'm sort of interested in you consciously funding marginalized groups and whether you've had any backlash from that. And I'm thinking of things that happen in England. For example, as an example of in arts funding in the UK is now being focused towards such marginalized groups, and there is a kind of backlash from the people who normally got funded to say, well, why are you doing this? You know, you're not looking at the best art anymore. You are just funding certain people. And I wondered if you'd experienced any kind of backlash from trying to focus your funding on marginalized groups in society.
That's a great question. Thank you. It's interesting that it's sort of phrased that way, that you're not funding the best art anymore.
That's debatable.
But you know what I mean? But not necessarily from you, but the
sure.
people who have asked you those
yeah.
questions to sort of suggest that the best art might come from one place and not another. Yes, there has been maybe backlash in the world, but maybe some questions. And I also work towards grant making towards the protection of immigrant and refugee communities, as well as Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities. And there certainly has been some, I would say, sort of more political backlash with respect to the protection of Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities because there is a latent and rather pervasive Islamophobia emanating from this administration and for more than just this administration. And so the notion of contributing to these communities, there are questions that are being asked of, well, why are you contributing to terrorists? And as someone who is of Muslim origin, I take great offense to a question like that, but I also recognize that it's sort of a question based in fear and one that has to be sort of addressed appropriately to acknowledge that fear is frankly irrational and that this does need to be addressed. But the question itself is can be problematic. And so there has been some backlash around that. And I think also prior to sort of the questions, there is philanthropy that sometimes refers to contributing to marginalized communities as risky grant making, which inherently makes it seem like it's more difficult. And what I would say is risky grant making is sort of making a grant to someone or a group where you don't know that there's going to be success. It doesn't necessarily matter what the background of that person is, but to inherently refer to grant making towards marginalized communities as risky is another way to sort of stifle and kind of silence the prospect of that grant making from the get-go, and then followed by the questions on the other end.
Yeah.
Can I just follow up with Nadia one more thing, and then Pochi, I want you to. Nadia, can you bring it down to a level of practically, what steps are you taking in this grant making to these groups? Give us an example of one or two steps of what you're doing to make this change, so we can understand it, not at a policy level,
sure.
but down.
Well, part of that, I think, one way to answer that is by looking at the amount of dollars that have been contributed to communities of color. And it is woefully short in comparison to organizations that are primarily led by white men, for the most part, and also by white women. So I work at Democracy Fund. We have a fairly substantial budget of grant making on a very large basis towards the sort of protection perception of democracy in the United States. But the dollars that have been contributed to MASA, Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities, have been fairly nominal in comparison.
What does that group you said?
Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities. So, for example, there are funding collaboratives that are focused towards grant making towards these communities. They are barely reaching over the $1 million mark in terms of their grant making. And in comparison, there are programs related to government oversight and accountability and other projects that are nearing the $20 million range. And so that's a significant, significant difference. And so in one way, actually prioritizing communities that have been marginalized and trying to deliver dollars there in and of itself is just a way of trying to balance where the dollars are going to.
And what would an example be of how, when you get the equity in those dollars going, what do they do with it? What's an action project that money might stimulate?
So one example is a project referred to as ISPU, the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. They're regarded as one of the first, and I apologize, I'm answering all the questions, so all of the questions can go to my colleagues after this.
Yeah, I want to bring it down from a policy level to
an
example.
But ISPU, for example, is regarded as the first American Muslim think tank in the United States. And this is, I'll share a brief example of precisely what they're doing, but they're providing research and data on American Muslim communities and more. They've been reached out to by journalists over the many years asking questions about the Muslim American community. And so we actually made a grant to them to develop training materials and a webinar for journalists on learning more about the community, on how to cover the community better, such that the narratives pertaining to these communities aren't solely based in just terrorism, but rather also in the contributions and the lived experiences, the human experiences that these communities have in the United States.
Okay. Getting there. All right, good. You wanted to say something, Poji, please.
Yeah, this is not so much a question for my fellow panelists as much as a question for all of you to think about. And that is, we are using the term privilege, and there are different ways to look at that. There's question of discrimination, which I think is what Nadia is. I think it's kind of like two sides of a coin, right? On one side, you call it privilege. On the other side, you can call it discrimination. That's one way to interpret that. So there's a discrimination aspect. There is a question of justice. What is justice for all, right? And that's not the same as discrimination. And then there's the equal opportunity, which, again, is a hallmark of what we think of as the American ideal for democracy. So I want, you know, particularly as the audience starts thinking of questions, you know, try to think in terms of what aspect you are really particularly interested in. Now, I'm not criticizing anything that either of my panelists are saying. I am going to make a case that the journey through entrepreneurship is one of the ways to break through some of those barriers. Now, you will still face those issues. You will face discrimination. You will face competition from people who do have privilege. You will face injustices. It's all there. And by the way, that's the way society works. Every society is complex, and it's not so simple. But still, you know, we all have to do what we can.
Great. There are so many great questions, especially from you students. I'm really very impressed. And Poochie, I want to ask you this one, which I thought was fascinating. What justifies hoarding of wealth by entrepreneurs once they achieve success, like Jeff Bezos, like everybody, like Mark Zuckerberg?
Okay, Zuckerberg is not a good example because he has promised to give away 90% of his money, just as Bill Gates has, and they're doing charitable things. They're doing, at least ostensibly, really trying to give back. I will address the question very specifically, but I want to make a preface, which is that we forget that capitalism, okay, the idea of capitalism, production of goods and services, is actually a tool that helps our societies grow and evolve. If we didn't do that, society would never change. We would not actually have a better life, which we do, of course. Now, that's the concept. And as a tool, it also needs to evolve, right? Every tool. You have a saw that you saw wood with. You have to sharpen it from time to time. Kitchen knives, you have to sharpen them. They have to evolve. And as you get, a society becomes better educated and more aware of the complex issues, the tools have to evolve as well. So one thing I want to suggest is thinking about capitalism, again, as a tool, as a practical implementation, and less on the ideology. Because ideology is where it's easy to say, well, you and I are opposite and we're going to fight. We're going to have a conflict. But if we say we both want a better tool for a better society, we can move in that direction. So the question was, hoarding of wealth.
About the hoarding of all the money by these entrepreneurs.
Guess
they don't
what?
They don't sound as nice as you make them out to be.
Oh, no, they're not nice. Entrepreneurs are not nice people.
Well, forget the
answer. Absolutely not nice people. entrepreneurs are dedicated to solving problems, and they are very competitive, so they want to win, right? They want to win. And making money is one of the ways that we keep score. Some people like to keep score of how successful you are. At the same time, there are people, again, who think about making money, again, the capitalist idea, not just the goods and services now, but actually using that wealth that they create in order to also help society. So Warren Buffett is a great example of that. He also has given away 90% of his fortune, you know, how many, $60 billion of dollars, and Bill Gates and so on. Now, they are the exceptions. Granted, there are exceptions. The problem is human nature. We are all selfish. We all have our insecurities. We all have greed and avarice. You know, the seven deadly sins started thousands of years ago, probably at the origins of humankind, and we still live with them today. How can we change that? That's up to you. That's up to all of you as young people to really think about, what is your responsibility? How can I be accountable to society, for society that gives me this opportunity, whether I'm privileged or not?
You know, to the students, somebody asked this good question. If the United States adopted a free education system, a free higher education system, could the gap between privileged peoples and unprivileged peoples be bridged? Does anyone want to take that on?
I think it could. I mean, and I'm talking, I guess, about from my own experience of a time when higher education was free in the UK for a time, and sadly it's not now. Sadly, it's only going in one direction, and that is in the same direction as in your country is going, where higher education is increasingly becoming something that's very expensive and for privileged people, and I can see that in the arts, certainly. I'm a great believer in, I think higher education should be free for everybody. And I think that's the only way that you can sort of, that's the only civilized thing to do in a civilized society, to have higher education able to all, open to all. And, the access is on ability, but it also, I think you need to take into account the different circumstances of people. It's not a level playing field. I think you need to understand that. And you need to have a conscious bias towards people who have not had those opportunities. That's what I think.
I want to answer this another way, which in the Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Finland, they still have free higher education, university, college level education for their students, but they also have the highest tax rate, arguably in the world, income tax, personal income tax, and there's very little entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship is difficult. See, the problem is the competitiveness, the idea that you want to have a chance to grow something and it be meaningful. Again, it's a little different from greed. It's kind of related to that, but it's really more that if I do something, if I can accomplish something, I want it to be tangible. I want to see some outcome from that. And if everything that you earn and your companies earn all gets taxed away, which is, of course, how you pay for things like education and the medical care, right? That's all taken care of also by the government. This wonderful, you have this wonderful stable society where you have less, you know, the so-called called Gini coefficient between the have-nots, the haves and have-nots, the highest income and lowest income. You know, it's a more flat society in that sense. So perhaps that's one way to reduce, eliminate some of this privilege. Of course, again, there's a whole set of laws as well as customs, and you know, taxation is obviously the key lever that the government can apply, and education gives the young people an opportunity.
Can I just add something? In the UK, the system is that the students have loans, and I don't know that that's the case here.
Yes.
Students have loans, and they have to pay it back only if they earn a certain amount of money. And after a number of years have gone, I mean, this was introduced about 5 years ago now, I think. The government, it's the findings are that so few graduates look like they're ever going to be able to pay their loans off. It's actually costing the government just about the same as it would do if they actually let them go for nothing. You know, and just to add personally, I'd be very happy to pay a lot more tax if it was free education. You know, but there has to be a kind of sacrifice. People who've got something have to kind of pay.
I agree with that. And to Michael's other point as well of... Yes, I think that that's one aspect in creating, hopefully, a more meritocracy in some way or another, but it doesn't necessarily address the power imbalance in terms of access to education, in terms of who would be able to be admitted, and what the processes would be for whom is able to be admitted, because we know that students of color, that women are disproportionately impacted when it comes to being able to have access to higher education and more.
Yep.
If the questions I'm getting are an example of what's coming out of middle schoolers right now, I have hope for the future. These questions are many, and they're very good, and sorting through them is one of the greatest challenges I've had as a moderator. Pochi, let me ask you this question that somebody asked you. Will capitalism ever be able to put a damper on the ever-growing class divide?
Yeah, that is actually a very good question, and
tell me.
You know, it's never really thought of it quite that way, because regardless of the reality of a class divide, so you know, you have umpteen millions of dollars, you come from a modest background. That's really not the issue, you know, and I think this is again very important to remember. What we are objecting to in this concept of privilege that we on the panel are talking about is really more the discrimination side, right? That somehow people with privilege have more opportunity, they have more access, they don't get pulled over for driving or whatever it is. And really it is a reflection of privilege. You know, again, I said these are two sides of the same coin, but the fundamental issue still is human nature. What are we teaching our children in school? What are we teaching our children at home about the value of being a human being, you know, regardless of what label we want to put on them, black, white, yellow, or rich or poor? You know, the point is the labels. If we keep fighting labels, we get increasingly doctrinaire and ideological, and then you get into this big fuss about, okay, how do we want to judge this label, right? So there's this huge scandal, not scandal. There are these DNA testing kits, right? One is called 23andMe. And in the television ads, these people say, oh, you know, I thought my family was Irish because my father has an Irish name, I have this Irish name. And then this gentleman goes through, has the test, finds out he's like only 15% or less, and he's mostly German or something like that. You know, our labels are created by people who want to classify other people for different reasons. This is the problem. And we associate these labels with certain characteristics that we consider less desirable. And that's the foundation of the discrimination and all the problems. So actually, you know, one whole theory, we could have a great debate, I'm sure, that if, in fact, capitalism could be freer, which it is not so free today, okay? The Wall Street and the financial industry, they have a very tight control over a lot of things, and there is definitely discrimination against non-whites. If there really were possible to have a freer type of economy, freer type of capitalism, it theoretically it could through entrepreneurship, right? People could actually create businesses that would support themselves and their communities.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to keep you on spot one more time because I think your experience at UC Berkeley is very relevant in this good question that says, what do you think about the dilemma created when you try to make up for the disadvantage by now giving preference to the previously disadvantaged, now the advantaged group becomes the disadvantaged in the long run?
Okay, excellent. Excellent, timely question. I know Nadia can't wait to jump in on that
one. Not at all.
No, please do. You know, the University of California at Berkeley is very much like here, the University of Colorado in Boulder, liberal, forward-thinking, more humanist, I would call it. And the university administration over the years has tried many different things, certainly for women, to have more women in sports and scholarships and a number of different things, and the blacks as well. There have been various things. You know, and today, obviously, in our national politics, as well as kind of, you know, rumblings in the Congress, there is indeed a backlash, right? And you can argue whether it's justified or not, but there is a backlash because if you try to rebalance what you perceive as a privilege on the one side, and you try to support more privilege on the other, then isn't that also discrimination? And I want to leave that really as an open question, because obviously my opinion really doesn't matter. I think it's a very complex issue. I think it's not so simple to say, and this is where we can probably have a debate on, you know, how much impact you can really have and what are the long-term consequences of trying to do this kind of rebalancing. Now, that's not to say we shouldn't do that. We definitely need to do that because, by definition, the disadvantaged don't have the resources. So how do we make those resources available? How can we enable those people to have the opportunities, the more equal opportunities? But we need to be thinking about what will the eventual impacts be. And these are long term. This might be, you know, a generation later. So it's very difficult to do that. And so I guess I'm just arguing that, yes, we need to do as much as we can today, and we need to be thinking about what we should be looking for in the future.
Okay. Nadia, would you like to comment on that?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, isn't it inevitable to make a fairer society that the group of people who are privileged have to step back, have to lose something? I mean, they have to give something if they want a fairer society. People, you know, white, privileged, middle class people like me, lower middle class, okay, but I'm still privileged, have to lose something. Things have to change. I have to not be in the position of power that I'm in. That position of power has to be by somebody who is of a maybe a different colour, a different gender, a different type of person to me entirely. That it seems there's only so many resources. If one group is going to have more, then another group kind of has to have less, and we have to accept that. I accept that.
You accept that. Nadia, please comment.
Sure. I just don't think that I don't think that remedying an imbalance is discriminatory. I think remedying an imbalance is remedying an imbalance.
And do you want to make the case for that more strongly, to say the big difference it makes? Does your foundation have data to prove now? Can we say this has made a big difference, that we are opening doors more for the disadvantaged now, and it's proving to be very successful? Pardon, microphone. Oh, for me, microphone.
I think I don't have that kind of data with me. I'm sorry.
Okay.
So I can't necessarily answer that specific question.
Okay.
Okay, I want to amend something, which is whether you think of this economy as a zero-sum activity or you think of it as a positive sum, meaning it's going to continue growing. And that's also fundamental to the concept of entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship cannot exist if you think of everything as zero-sum, have and have not. That's simply, you know, that's just codifying ideologically saying, that's it. There's only $100, and if you have 70, then I only have 30. Equal opportunity, justice. Again, justice is very fundamental. We need to emphasize more. What do we mean by justice? What is a just society? What do we mean by equal opportunity? I think those absolutely are, you know, principles that we would all agree with, all of you would agree with, because that's what gives us hope. If we think that we are disadvantaged because someone else is privileged and has the 70%, what am I going to do? Right? I'm not even going to be motivated to try to do something constructive. I will very easily be led, tempted into the dark side and become violent, become criminal activity, because frankly it's easier, right? It's an easier way for me to move in that direction. We have to believe that society, in order to grow, must be positive sum, must continue to grow and enrich itself in fundamental ways as well as in a material sense.
But from where I'm standing, capitalism feeds on the class divide. It feeds on it. It needs an underclass, and it needs the current system in order to thrive, because it needs a group of people, because it's motivated by money and profit, fundamentally.
And Michael, somebody wants to ask you this question: if your roots are so much of what defines you in your society, does it mean that no matter how hard you try, there's no way you're going to pave your own path through the world? What stops you, knowing that you're saying you're not the upper class and you're never going to be?
It's to do with tiny little things. It's not to do with your job. It's to do with attitudes. It's to do with the way you're spoken to. And anybody of color understands this. And you know, there are levels of this. There are levels of discrimination, if you like. And mine is relatively mild, but it is a class thing. And I do believe that you can't rise above your class in the UK, because you're always treated in a way that relates to where you were born and your position and what you were. You can't escape that. You really can't escape it. As I say, it's in the small communication.
Give us an example of what that would be. What can't you do because of the class you're in?
You can't rise above a certain level, I would argue, in job, in career terms. There is always going to be a kind of ceiling. There is always going to be a level of stopping that. You can't, in social terms, gain access into a certain level of society, of social interaction. You are stopped from doing that. These are things that are invisible. They're invisible. They're not visible, but they are very powerful.
And do you see that here at all? That we?
I'm not as familiar enough with the States to understand whether that is still there. I mean, you know, as I said in my introduction, the theory of the American dream is that you work hard and you can buy your way into privilege. You can buy your way into power. I'm saying that doesn't happen in the UK. I'm not sure it happens here. I'm not sure whether that, as I was saying, whether that the American dream is a myth. I think it is a myth. In order to keep the status quo and to keep a level of power there intact.
Thank you. Did you want to say something?
I always have something to say.
And I'm going to keep you tight, too. I'm going to keep it tight so we can get all these questions in.
Yeah, so... Again, I'm listening to Michael, and I completely respect what he's saying. I am a first-generation immigrant. My parents were first-generation immigrants as well. And I also, growing up and living and working in the United States, also abroad, but in the United States, I would say I also have faced sort of this. It's not overt discrimination. Sure. Certainly wasn't pulled over by a policeman. I thought I did that once, but... It is the little things. And, for example, in Silicon Valley, this is very interesting. This kind of argues both ways. But, for example, if you look at all of these high-tech companies, including all the very successful ones, it's like 90% of the technical talent, the engineers, are foreigners. Of course, they're mostly Asians, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, other parts of Asia, as well as Indians. And the Indians do very well. Very few Chinese ever rise to be CEO, or chairman. I mean, when they found the company in the beginning, they can have that title, but relatively quickly they get replaced. On the other hand, only recently, in probably the last decade or so, Indians have turned out to be quite successful and in rising up. Again, this is more of a startup environment. This is not saying you go to IBM and so on. But I'm sure there is this concept of sort of glass ceiling, right, just as there has been for women and so on. So the glass ceiling definitely exists, but this is sort of the point. I mean, yes, do you want to say, as a minority, do I say, I need to play the game that the aristocracy has, right? That I want to be CEO of IBM. Yeah, guess what? Never happen. It will simply never happen. And it's only very recently that we have women as CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, at probably less than 5, and chairmen and so on. There are lots and lots of reasons. But that's the point. If you think about these institutions and say, I want to be part of this institution, which arguably has the power and the power to decide who to promote and so on, yes, you won't get there. But why do you need to be part of that institution? That's the question that drives entrepreneurs. I don't need to be part of IBM. I can create something better, right, for myself and for others.
Good point to you young entrepreneurs. You know, I've gotten 3 questions here on this college admissions scandal going on now. And I think our audience wants you to have a reaction. Basic question is, do you believe that the recent college admissions scandal is an example of U.S. aristocracy?
Of course.
And what could we anticipate as next would be an interesting question, too.
I don't know what we can anticipate as next. It's not a question for me, frankly. But
more of the same.
I absolutely think it is, yes. Sorry, I said I can't answer the second question of what's coming next with respect to that. I think
is this totally an example of U.S. aristocracy?
Yes.
It's an example of U.S. arrogance.
It kind of relates to what Nadia was saying, I think, from what I understand, about having who decides on the funding sort of thing. So, you know, if the funding is decided by the people instead of some kind of group of people who think they know better, maybe that's the problem with the admissions services, because it's a group of people who think they know better.
But it's also that, I mean, these parents paid their way, paid for their children to get into universities and paid to disadvantage other people from getting in. And that is an absolute, I think, example of what privilege can do and the power that's associated with it and the power imbalance, and that there is no meritocracy when it comes to this. It just matters how much money it is that you had and what it is that you can spend to sort of make it happen.
Mm. But again, this too, Koji, because another aside on this was, what do you think the proper punishment should be for these parents?
Well, I just want to comment. Obviously, this has been going on for a long time, just never quite reached this scale, right? And, you know, alumni have privileges, right? If I'm, an alumnus of UC Berkeley, if my children had wanted to go there, or I have a PhD from Princeton, you know, they have a slightly better chance of having their application reviewed a little bit more favorably. You know, it just goes on forever. And it is about being part of an in-group, people that we think we are familiar with, that share our values. That's sort of the concept. But, of course, when it gets out of hand, and this is honestly, this is one of the beauties of the American system, part of the American myth. We all live in myths. We have to have myths. You know, reality is so depressing. There's not much hope left if we only deal with reality. But we have to be careful what we think of as not reality, and myths and dreams are really very, very important. So I think we want to, again, focus on what we need to do to have more of the justice. What is, in fact, a more just and fair way of managing college admissions? I think that is happening. You're seeing the schools react to that, and obviously a lot of other schools haven't had that opportunity, so they're still more low level. But this is how society evolves, right? You need some outlier, you know, the not quite master criminal kind of thing, but that's what happens in the justice system too, right? They go after the big fish in order to make examples of them, but you can't catch all the little fish, right? Let's be honest. We cannot completely eliminate criminals and people who continuously break the law. We can only hope to catch a certain number, and we try to catch the big ones in order to make an example.
I'd just like to say that I don't believe that the admission system or the thing driving the admission system ought to be grades. I don't think it ought to be grading. Ought to be about other things. Circumstances should be taken into account. Okay. The grading system isn't a level playing field.
I would just add with the criminal justice system, it hasn't always been go after the big fish. To be frank, with the NYPD and with a program like Stop and Frisk, that when, you know, 87% of the people who are stopped in Stop and Frisk are Black and Latino, and only 10% are white, most of those people are being arrested for petty crimes, that's not exactly going after the largest fish. But I understand your point, but... The power imbalance in that is that the largest fish actually don't necessarily face the same kind of jail sentences that others do.
Yeah, that's a different angle. I agree with that, too.
Right. As we come in the home stretch here, I want to bring it down with a question that that's fairly practical and important in terms of what we all can do. I'd like you all to answer this question. What do you think parents need to do to make sure that their kids understand privilege and help us to dissolve that? If you're a parent or not, what do you think? Where does it begin? What are the first questions we should ask or comments we should make? Nadia, let's start with you. I can pull that microphone.
I'm not a parent, so I'm.
What would you tell a child?
I would tell. I think that there are inherent privileges, there are inherent benefits that a dominant group sometimes has over those that aren't in the dominant group, and that we are not supposed to be innocent bystanders to that.
I've got three children. Actually, they've told me about privilege more than I could ever tell them, because they're far more aware than I am, and they've made me more aware. Mm-hmm. Of those things, and that's a generational thing, which is great.
Yeah,
because I think their children might tell them as well other things.
What are they telling you?
They're telling me about my unconscious bias. They're showing me that I have a bias that I didn't even know I had. They're pointing it out. They're catching me out, and they're right.
Very good.
Yeah, so I have two children who are now quite adult. One is in the mid-30s, one is just about 30. And I'm experiencing the same thing that Michael just mentioned. They call us on some of these things, you know, discriminative attitudes or... let's just start with that. Not so much privilege per se. You know, fortunately, my wife and I have been able to give them... Well, actually, no, that's not correct. Our daughter, when she was young, because we live in a nice neighborhood, you know, suburban.
Fairly privileged.
Yeah, you would call it privileged. Not super wealthy, but definitely privileged. And she resented that. She hated that label. You know, our city just outside of Berkeley is called Orinda, O-R-I-N-D-A. And kind of locally people will speak of Arindans in a slightly disparaging tone, right? Just, oh, they're those snooty kinds of people. We certainly were not that kind, and our daughter just resented that label being applied to her, because she and the friends that she made in middle school and in high school were completely from the other side. She you know, it was part of her rebellion. But I think it's part of her honesty, and she's an intensely honest person. I think this next generation, you know, our middle school schoolers here, even our college students at Boulder, you know, it is part of this culture, the technology, the social media, all of this stuff. They have a different sense of what they belong to, how they want to belong, what kinds of friends, what kinds of associations they have. So it's not that they're ignorant of everything else. Sometimes parents think that they just don't seem to understand, you know, the way things are or should be. And I think we're constant. Well, just speaking for myself, my wife and I are constantly surprised at, yeah, how much they really do know. You know, they're pretty smart, and they have information, they have opinions that are different from ours, but, you know, make us stop and think.
I think we're concluding with this concept of that, in your answer to your student's question, which is so good, it's you who will teach the parents. And Nadia, your point of witnessing and speaking up, it seems to me that's how barriers will be broken down. And I want to thank you for being so attentive to this wonderful panel. Thank you all for being here.